There's a new book out this week from the travel guide maker Lonely Planet about the night sky, specifically where to see the stars. Most of us don't get a good view at home because of light pollution, which affects 99% of the population of the U.S. So let's find out where to go from the author of Dark Skies, A Practical Guide to Astrotourism. That would be Valerie Stimmick. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
So first of all, I have to say that, for most Americans, especially those who live in cities or in suburbs, they don't have a very good view of the night sky. How far do you have to go from the major metro areas to actually see the stars in the way that you should be able to?
In most of the cities in America, you can get to a good night sky view within 1 to 2 hours. The 90-minute range seems to be ideal. I do a lot of research on that. I actually work on a series of city stargazing guides, and usually within 90 minutes, you can get far enough out that you'll be able to see the Milky Way, and you'll be able to see if there's a meteor shower going on, you'll be able to see that.
And where is the best place in the – let's start with the United States, because this book looks at the whole world. But in the U.S., what would you say is the best place to see the stars?
That's a really tricky answer. But I would say if you're going to plan a trip to any part of the U.S., the Southwest, particularly Utah, like Southwest Utah, Northern Arizona, Eastern Southern California, There are some great national parks. And national parks are a huge advantage because they're already preserved and kind of underdeveloped. And that usually means that there's going to be a lot better protection of the night sky overhead as well.
A lot less light pollution.
Correct.
Yeah, and one of the things that you talk about in this book, by the way, is that for places that do have lights, the lights are starting to get smarter, meaning that we are putting in lights on streets, et cetera, that don't shine up, they just shine down, and so therefore they don't create as much light pollution.
Exactly. That's one of the things we worked really hard to define in this book is what is light pollution, which there are some great people who've already done a lot of research. And the idea isn't that you have no light or that things aren't illuminated, which should be. It's just that the illumination is exactly on what you need to have illuminated. So if you need a road to be illuminated to see to drive at night, let's make sure that the light isn't spilling out onto the sides of the road where there might be wildlife. It's not pointing up for no reason because nobody's driving up above the light. A lot of cities have been starting to look at this, too, because they understand the impact it's having.
Do you think that we're getting a lot better at that, at not causing so much light pollution around this country?
We're getting there. There's some communities, especially smaller communities, that have been doing some great work. I was actually recently traveling in Nebraska, and there are some communities there that are Nebraska, because Nebraska is quite sparsely populated. The towns are starting to say, hey, this is something people are interested in. Let's see what it's going to take to get our community light compliant. Big cities, it's harder because there's a lot more bureaucracy and the cities are established. One of the biggest cities that has a great record for light management is Tucson, Arizona.
I was happy to see that one of your best spots in the U.S. for stargazing, for those of us on the East Coast, is in Pennsylvania, Cherry Springs State Park in central Pennsylvania.
That's a tiny little pocket of great dark skies. And I wish we had more space in the Eastern Seaboard because it's one of the most populated regions of the country. But because of that, it's a lot harder to find really nice dark sky spots.
In this book, you get into astrophotography. I've always noticed it's very difficult to take my phone and take a picture, even of the moon, which looks so big and bright, and then you take a photo and it just doesn't turn out the way you want it to. What are some of the tips you have for people that want to take astrophotographs?
Sure. Well, your phone is not going to be the right tool for that. That's the starting point. You need a device, a camera that has manual controls so that you can control the shutter speed, you can control the exposure, you can control the aperture, which are some sort of technical things. And all the photographers are probably shaking their head that this is quite a simplistic explanation. But that manual control is critical to getting the settings right to allow the right amount of light in to get the photo that you're looking for. The other one that a lot of people talk about and that I never go anywhere without is a remote and a tripod. So our heartbeats and our finger on the shutter are enough to disturb a camera, especially if you're doing a longer exposure, such that the stars that you're trying to photograph will be fuzzy or will be wobbly. The last one, and this is sort of a more technical one, is when you are out shooting at night, you should set your focus out to infinity, but then just bring it back just a little bit, because the way that the camera works is if you go all the way to infinity, no part of the photo may be in focus. So pulling it back a little bit typically solves that.
Now, we've been talking about places where you can stargaze in the United States. The stars that we typically see are different from the ones that you would see if you were looking up in the Southern Hemisphere, right?
Correct.
So what do they get to see down there that we miss?
I actually know this. I took my first trip to Southern Hemisphere in March to Chile. I was scouting for the recent solar eclipse, and it was astonishing to see the night sky in the Southern Hemisphere because it feels a little bit like we grew up with the night sky and we think we know it, and then you go see this other night sky, but it is still our sky. So you can see some of the Northern Hemisphere constellations. You can see Orion, which is a very popular winter constellation. It's upside down from where I was viewing in Chile. So I'm standing there, I'm like, why are the stars in the
wrong place? Why is his belt like that, right?
Yeah, yeah. And I finally tipped my whole body over and, oh, there. Okay, so that's one fun thing is you can see some of the constellations you know, but they're going to be inverted. You can see more of the Milky Way, and it has very distinct shapes in the Southern Hemisphere. There are obviously different stars. And one of the great things that I personally fell in love with was being able to see the Magellanic Clouds, which are two disorganized galactic formations near the Milky Way. So you can actually see these sort of other galaxies.
Now, you look at places all over the world. Is there a place that stands out to you that you would tell our listeners, if you're going to fly somewhere and travel just for the night sky, you should go here? Where would it be?
That is a tough choice. I'm going to give you two. One is New Zealand. I think New Zealand is a great candidate. If you look in the book, we've represented New Zealand in every section, I believe, which is wonderful. I've actually never been there, but it's number one on my list currently. And then the other one I'm actually leading a tour there is Jordan. The country of Jordan is a very tourist-friendly country in the region. It's got great hospitality infrastructure, and the night skies above certain parts of the country are just spectacular. And I'm really looking forward to bringing some people there. I'm going in March, bring some people there and showing them what makes the country special and the night sky and the Arabic heritage in astronomy. We're going to kind of do this whole big tour that introduces people to that.
Now, one of the other sections of the book is about going to observatories. There are some incredible observatories all over the world. Can you actually just go in and have a look up at the sky through their telescopes?
It depends on the observatory. So, for example, Mauna Kea, which is a mountain in the Big Island of Hawaii, generally considered one of the best places for observing in the world. Most of those observatories are not open to the public after dark, because they're using them to do research. You can tour them during the day, but you can't necessarily tour them at night. So almost every observatory has their own rules. But a lot of smaller observatories, especially sort of in the periphery of metropolitan areas, for example, we have one here in Oakland called Chabot, they do public nights where you can show up. It's free for the public. You can go up to the telescope and you can look at whatever they have trained on for that particular window of time.
You also get into places where you can see something that I've never seen and I've always wanted to, which is the Aurora Borealis, the Northern Lights.
Yeah, I actually grew up in Alaska. So for me, seeing the Northern Lights wasn't this amazing bucket list worthy item until I moved away.
It's just
and
like
I realized,
Tuesday you get to see
coming home from high school, oh, wow, the Northern Lights are going to be out tonight. We'll go see them.
So what's the best place to see them in America, North America?
I would always advocate for Alaska.
Okay.
Yeah, you don't need a passport. That makes it really, really easy. Most people go to Alaska in the summer. If you go in the winter, it's going to be a lot less crowded, much lower cost than going in the summer. There's some really cool events in the winter in Alaska, like the Iditarod, and you can go see the start and all those kinds of things. And you can see the Northern Lights, too.
One more thing that you get into here that I want to ask you about is eclipses and the best places. And there are people that travel all over the world. We just spoke to somebody who was getting on a cruise in Tahiti to go down into the South Pacific to see the last solar eclipse. But we remember the one a couple of years ago that was visible in the United States, and it was such an amazing sort of national moment of unity to take a few minutes and look up and see the eclipse. The next one that will be visible here is 2024, if I'm not mistaken. Total solar eclipse, April 2024?
Correct.
Wow. And so you tell people in this book where they can go and have a look at that one.
We do. Yep. We look at the path of totality and we looked at various metropolitan areas and other interesting points along the route that we would advise people to go to. And what's funny is when I would reach out to these destinations, they are already planning. They fully understand how big this will be for them.
How did you get so interested in this?
It's a combination of things. I think growing up in Alaska, having access to really good dark skies through a major portion of the year every year was critical to me. Being able to see the Milky Way and seeing the Northern Lights, I distinctly remember seeing the Hale-Bopp Comet.
I remember that,
97. My grandfather was into meteorology and astronomy, and he pointed out the space shuttle at one point. We could see the shuttle lit up in the rising sun. He said, oh, that's the shuttle. He was following along enough that he knew that it would be visible and pointed it out while we're standing at the school bus stop waiting for the bus to come.
Wow. What do you say to people, and there are people out there, who just don't really care about the stars and they don't ever take time to look up or find a place where they can really see them?
Well, I feel very sad. I think that there's this great humbling experience in seeing the night sky and getting a sense for our place in the universe. That's what I encourage everyone to do. That's why I'm leading tours. That's why I wrote the book. I want people to get out and see the night sky.
That is Valerie Stimmick, whose new book is called Dark Skies, A Practical Guide to Astrotourism. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And you can read an excerpt from the book at hereandnow.org.